You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
So good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this Brookings event, where we'll be discussing the new book published by Norm Eisen and his wonderful Brookings co-authors on Democracy's Defenders. Holding up the book now, it is available now from the Brookings Institution Press. Before we get into the deep of it, I want to start it off with my former Brookings colleagues and one of the authors of the book, Norm Eisen. Norm, let me hand over to you for a quick intro, and then we'll head straight into the conversation.
Thank you, Alina, and welcome, Alina and Jeff. I'm very pleased to be able to join everyone today to present and discuss the implications of my new volume, Democracy's Defenders. You should be able to see a link to purchase a copy of the book if you are so inclined, at the bottom of your screen. The book stems from my service in Embassy Prague from 2011 to 2014, and my discovery of the rediscovery of the incredible story of the peaceful transition of power in 1989 in then Czechoslovakia, the so-called Sametové revoluce, the Velvet Revolution, and the role of the United States Embassy of American diplomacy, fulfilling the historic mission, the privilege that we as American diplomats had enjoyed for so many decades of leading democracy, and how very low-key, subtle, and in the background, the American Embassy did so much to make that revolution velvet. I was so interested that I got over 50 cables describing the embassy's role declassified, and this new book contains those cables seeing the light of the day for the first time ever, together with an introduction, a lengthy introduction, putting the cables in context, explaining how we got to that point, and a long afterwards, following up on the results of the cables and the United States diplomatic efforts, including our financial and other democracy building efforts in the years afterwards, and the ways in which America's work in and immediately after the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia and then in the Czech Republic and in Slovakia made possible today's democracy in those two nations, but also some of the failures of American diplomacy that seeded some of the challenges that those two vibrant democracies, but like democracies everywhere, are facing challenges, how America was responsible to some extent for both the ups and the downs. Before we turn to a discussion of the themes of the book and the meaning of American diplomatic leadership today, which I submit to you is flagging in the era of COVID, I'd like to acknowledge some of the individuals who were my co-authors, my collaborators on the book. That includes my fellow contributors, Kelsey Landau, Dr. Mikulas Peshta, Narelle Gilchrist, and David Fishman, as well as Teddy Becker-Jacob, an unacknowledged but fantastic contributor to the book. The editorial team at the Brookings Institution Press, what a pleasure it has been to work with them. Bill Finan, Cecilia Gonzalez, and Elliot Beard. My Brookings colleagues, John Allen, Daryl West, Suzanne Maloney, Tom Wright, Letty Davalos, so many others who have made the book possible. All of our donors and contributors, including those who support the progress in the Open Society Project, which this book is a product of, none more than Dan Berger. I want to thank Dan Berger of Philadelphia, an incredible American philanthropist, for his support. And with that, I'll remind everyone that for social media on this event, you can tag hashtag Democracy's Defenders. You can submit questions for speakers by emailing events@brookings.edu or on Twitter by tweeting at BrookingsGov. I want to thank introduce Jeff and Alina before turning it back over to them. Alina, Dr. Polyakova, is president and CEO of CEPA, the Center for European Policy Analysis, a former colleague of mine at Brookings, where she was a fellow and the director for global democracy and emerging technology at the institution. Previously, she also served in her distinguished career as director of research for Europe and Eurasia at the Atlantic Council. She's an expert on transatlantic relations with deep experience on European politics, Russian foreign policy, and digital technologies. Her most recent book is The Dark Side of European Integration. Alina will be joined on the panel today by my friend, Dr. Jeffrey Gedman, the editor-in-chief of The American Interest and the CEO of the TAI Group. Jeff has also been president and CEO of the London-based Legatum Institute, of the Aspen Institute in Berlin. I got to know him when he served as president and CEO of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and was a wonderful, we overlapped and was just a wonderful partner in advancing democracy, freedom of expression, freedom of the press, and truth in Europe and around the world. He's the author and editor of several books, including The Hidden Hand, Gorbachev and the Collapse of East Germany. Thank you, Jeff and Alina, for being with us today to celebrate Democracy's Defenders. Again, folks, you can see, forgive me, you can see the link, I hope, at the bottom of your screen. And with that, I'm passing it to Alina to moderate our discussion.
Well, thank you, Norm. It's really just such a pleasure to be back in a virtual format together with you and Jeff. After all the work we did together on trying to understand how to push back against democratic backsliding. And I know we will get to that, to what's happening today, and certainly some of the major questions and concerns that many, including yourself and Jeff, have raised about some of the recent expansions we've seen to really lock down executive control in so many societies, not just in Europe, as a result of the current crisis and where that may lead us. But before we get to that, I think what your book does so wonderfully is that it reminds us that the fight for democracy is a fight, that it's not something that we can take for granted, and that the United States and U.S. diplomats in particular played such a critical role in what ultimately became the greatest democratization process that we saw culminating with the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. But before we get to all that modern stuff, let's go back to the time period the book really starts with. So, Norm, you mentioned all of these rich cables that you gathered for the new book. I think it's so interesting when you do this kind of research. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you got your hands on them, what they're about, and what do you think we can learn from this, from these specific cables that are featured in the book?
Thanks, Alina. I got my hands on them when I was researching after I left the embassy and came to Brookings in 2014. And I was researching the previous book I wrote, history of the past 100 years as seen through the windows of the magnificent residence where the U.S. ambassador in Prague lives, where I lived. That 100 years exactly paralleled America's increased engagement in Europe, starting with Wilsonian entry into World War I. And in order to write the chapters on the end of the Cold War, I had to research that period. I realized that when I was looking, there had been a batch of cables that were declassified. But in reading that initial batch of cables, I realized that some of the most interesting cables had never been released. And I called my old friends at the State Department and asked why. And they explained to me that that the 50 or so cables contained some of the most sensitive information and were not suitable for release. So there were a variety of reasons. That was one of the reasons. And I pointed out that we would soon be coming up on the 30-year mandatory release of documents. Documents are supposed to be released. And I triggered the bureaucratic process, pushed it forward so that there are a variety of legal vehicles. I ended up using one called Mandatory Declassification Review. And just in the nick of time to check them before my last book came out, I got a big stack of these documents, but I barely scratched the surface. They were so full of riches that I decided to, with the kind encouragement of Brookings Press, my publisher, Bill Finan, I decided to devote a whole book to them. And in terms of what they're about, Alina and Jeff and all of you who are watching, what they're about is the secret sauce of American leadership in that 100-year period starting with Wilson's realization that democracy was not an American matter, it was not a European matter, it was a transatlantic matter. There are two anchors to American democracy in the United States and Europe. And all of the things that made America so admired, that made us the so-called leader of the free world, that made the State Department the most admired diplomatic institution in the world, are on exhibit in these cables as American diplomats from Ambassador Shirley Temple Black on down attempted to make sure that the forces of democracy succeeded in Czechoslovakia, but to do it without taking American ownership. The genius of American democracy support is that we inspire those who believe in democracy in any given country to do their very best. So they met, those diplomats met privately with the communist regime and warned them that violence would lead to serious consequences. They met privately with the dissidents and talked to them about how to proceed, how far to go, and how fast. They let the world know that they were watching. The ambassador even personally went to demonstrations at risk and life and limb. They wrote these 50-some brilliant cables, each one of which is like a newspaper or magazine story packed with detail and analysis, just the sheer caliber of the intellect and the quality and the desire to get to the truth so that folks back in Washington who were making the decisions could be informed on a day-to-day, hour-by-hour basis about what was unfolding in the Velvet Revolution in the streets. So those, and they finally, the cables shine with moral leadership, the determination to do the right thing, irrespective of the consequences. And that notion of America's role in the world, of the international nature of democracy, the loyalty to truth, morality as a leadership trait, and just sheer intelligence and goodness all come through. And that is the real story of these cables and how America supported the Velvet Revolution and the rebirth of democracy in Czechoslovakia.
Thank you, Norm. You know, one of the things that the book really highlights, I think, is you know, a few lines of story that are both very much, I think, untold in some ways, not just because the records were classified, as he said, until recently, but also because we often see 1989 and then what transpired in Central Eastern Europe after the fall of the Soviet Union as a sort of fait accompli, when, of course, it was not. It took blood, sweat, and tears on the part of many U.S. diplomats and civil society leaders, local civil society leaders in all these countries to make this happen. So, Jeff, let me pull you into this conversation a bit. The book tells the story, as Norm said, of the U.S. role in the Velvet Revolution itself, but also traces a line from what happened following 1989 in terms of the programs and reforms in both the Czech Republic and Slovakia after the separation. Some were backed by the U.S., and how that led to a really complex state of democracy in both countries today. Jeff, like Norm, you spent a long period of time living in the Czech Republic while you were serving as editor-in-chief of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. So you know the country well. How would you assess the present state of Czech democracy and democracy in Central and Eastern Europe more broadly?
I am unmuted now. Alina, thank you. And it's a pleasure being with you, Alina, and you, Norm, and big, big congratulations on this book and Kelsey and your other colleagues who made it possible. It's impressive. Alina, let me respond with 2 points. They're bookends, if you will. To the first point, if I may, the book is fascinating. And it's very valuable in so many different ways because it's for me at any rate, it's a snapshot, but a fluid one and a dynamic one of a period, you alluded to that, Alina, where the outcomes were not certain and nothing was actually preordained. And you have this window on diplomats, but through the cables, dissidents, citizens, other actors and players trying to shape a destiny. It's clear about how much was unclear. Diplomats trying to ascertain and establish public mood, motives, players, and trajectory. Very interesting, I think. And it's also the case that there are things that we were able to control and things we were less able to control. So just from a historical point of view, to have that window on a case study like this, an important, a monumental case study. Norm, I think you've done us a real service and provided real value. To what you asked about, Alina, I would go to the afterword and what you provide for us toward the end of the book, Norm, and I'm paraphrasing you, but there are many things that happened through revolution and through the demise of communism, which we applaud. And brought so much freedom to so many people who lived under so much tyranny for decades. But then we realized after that point and subsequently that there are certain things you say, Norm, that economic liberalization is essential but not sufficient. There are a number of things we've learned are essential but not sufficient. It's important to have fair and free elections. It's important to have a multi-party system. It's important to have freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. And to you, Norm, toward the end of your book, Economic Liberalization, but to build and grow a democracy has to do with institutions, sinking deep roots, being durable, and also culture, habits, values, behaviors, attitudes. And I think we've learned in a word, Alina, that for peoples who lived under communism for 4 decades, or in the case of the Soviet Union, 7 decades, to flip, to switch, to enter a new world and a new mindset It takes time. It has to be negotiated. And we don't get to impose or dictate or set the agenda. It has to be indigenous. It has to be authentic. And that's a process. And I think we're in the midst of a difficult moment in the process 30 years later.
Thank you, Jeff. So let me pick up with the point you are wrapping us up with, and then I'll take it over to Norm with the same question. And that's the point you make about the authenticity of the domestic civil society movements that are really the key actors when it comes to ensuring democratic resilience, maintaining the integrity of democratic institutions, and really pushing back during moments when democracies are facing incredible challenges. And certainly the crisis we're going through now is not the first challenge that we've seen in the post 1989 period. I think it's safe to say that, you know, civil society is a particularly salient force in the Czech Republic. Some of you who may be tuning in, I may have missed this, but late last year, protesters gathered on the eve of the 30th anniversary of the Velo Revolution and called for the resignation of the prime minister over some fraud allegations that were being reported on at the time. So given this tension that we often see between domestic civil society forces and the ruling governments in power with which, of course, the United States has to have diplomatic relations with. You know, now all of these countries are NATO allies, they're EU member states, the European Union, and Europe more broadly is a key and core U.S. ally that we depend on for so much in terms of ensuring our own prosperity and our own security in the United States. But given this tension, how can the U.S. continue to support those domestic, authentic actors in the world that we find ourselves in today?
Is that for me?
I'm going to take it to Jeff first, and then I'll take it back to you, Norm.
So Alina, there are things that we do as Americans in and outside of government, and through private sector and NGOs. And I think, in my view, democracy is better thought of as a process rather than an event. And so if you permit me just one moment, we live in a great democracy, the United States of America. It was started with a birth defect, a terrible one called slavery. We've had in this country segregation, Vietnam, Watergate, the assassination of JFK, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., and today a moment of considerable polarization and contention that involves many different issues. So if we look at other countries, at other points of transition, we should not be surprised that there are flaws and blemishes and twists and turns and setbacks. But I think for us, to answer your question directly, if we believe that institutions are important and checks and balances are important and things like independent courts in that context are important, let's say so and offer support of various means. If we believe that vibrant civil society is important and values such as pluralism and tolerance and respect for diversity, then let's say so. And then let's put our money where our mouth is and support the appropriate NGO actors or media actors or political forces. So I'll stop there.
The Norm, over to you, same question. What can the U.S. do now to support these democratic forces?
Well, Alina, the... in no particular order, and there is a void in U.S. leadership at the top levels, the president, the secretary of state, some of the more Trumpian ambassadors, although the current ambassadors to the Czech Republic, current ambassador to Czech Republic is very, very good. I'm thinking of Ambassador Grinnell in Germany, who then became the acting director of national intelligence here, reportedly headed over to an acting role at the Secret Service. There's a void at the top, because the message that is sent, both a direct message, an overt message, but also the message of example, is not one that is supportive of democracy. That leaves others to fill that role. And there still is a tremendous cadre of career ambassadors who promote democratic values and together with all their colleagues at the State Department, the other agencies who serve in our embassies. So that has continued. Non-executive actors become even more important. Members of Congress, and in particular Speaker Pelosi, who has a status around the world almost akin to a head of state, has stepped up to a much greater extent than was the case in either by Democratic or Republican predecessors before, because of this void. So you see her traveling the world, leading bipartisan delegations, emerging, for example, at the as the leading American voice at things like the 75th commemoration anniversaries of events marking milestones in World War II, or the Munich Security Conference. And then the third thing I would say is there's an even greater role for civil society, and that's where the three of us come in a little bit. Jeff and I, of course, co-chair the Transatlantic Democracy Working Group, bipartisan, and Alina, you're very active with the TDWG, which is a co-sponsor of today's event. We're a bipartisan group of former diplomats, government officials, thinkers, writers, scholars, analysts who value the transatlantic relationship, who see democracy as a good in itself, but also as a security, critical security issue. And we are very vocal in speaking out. And we know the European governments listen when we speak out about democracy, because sometimes we've gotten complaints from their diplomatic representatives here in the United States. So it's important for us to speak out about what's happening in places like Hungary, in Poland, and elsewhere around the continent. And of course, to speak also about issues with democracy in the other anchor of the security relationship, and the democratic one, United States.
Thank you, Norm. I just want to take a second to remind all of you who are tuned in to send us your questions via email or submit them via Twitter. Want to hear from those of you who are listening in, any questions you might have for both Norm and Jeff about the wonderful book, but just about what's happening in the world today. So I promise we talk about the current situation in a little bit more detail. Certainly, the coronavirus, COVID-19 crisis is top of mind for everyone for many different reasons, including the public health reasons, but also, of course, the kinds of economic effects the crisis is having. And it's also having political effects, which in recent weeks, many of our colleagues have also been raising the alarm around the reality that globally, in at least 84 countries, according to a recent Freedom House report, there have been various kinds of measures imposed to curb freedom of speech, civil liberties, other kinds of rights the citizens enjoy. And of course, there's a big question mark as to whether the crisis is being used by some perhaps authoritarian-minded leaders to continue this kind of executive control and to kind of chip away democratic checks and balances. And I want to get both of your perspectives on that. Obviously, one country in Central Eastern Europe that often comes to mind and certainly receives a huge amount of criticism is Hungary, under the control of the current Fidesz government and Prime Minister Orban, who has used emergency powers to place limits on freedom of speech and repress civil society. Recently, the government did announce that there would be an end date to those emergency powers. But certainly there's a big question as to what are sort of the lingering effects that we're going to see in Central Eastern Europe, especially, but across the world more broadly when it comes to democratic progress. We are already in sort of a democratic sag, if you will, across the world. So how will this crisis, you think, affect that trajectory? Or will this be a moment when perhaps people and citizens will stop taking our rights and freedoms for granted and we'll see greater pushback? So Jeff, maybe let me just start with you. Any piece of that you want to pick up, long-term ramifications, Hungary specifically, just what are your thoughts on how the crisis is manifesting itself in terms of the democratic trajectory we're seeing across the world and Central Eastern Europe specifically?
So Alina, thank you. I'll share a few brief thoughts, and then I'm eager to hear what Norm has to say and how he'll address it. To context, I think it's important to acknowledge that a number of things are happening all at once the last decade or so. And it's not just in Central Europe. We had a global financial crisis in 2008. It had its effects and has had impact on attitude toward capitalism and global capitalism. We had an election in 2016 where in the primaries, the two primary candidates, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, may have been oh so different, but they were the two protest candidates. They were the two anti-establishment candidates or throwing rocks at Wall Street and Washington, if you will. I think that if you look at what's happening in Central Europe, it fits into a context of crisis of confidence to some extent in democracy and capitalism's ability to deliver or lift those left out or left behind by developments in technology and globalization broadly. That's point one. Or basket one. Point two, or basket two, Alina, in my view, is the following. Where there are vacuums get filled. Or where there's a crisis, it's an opportunity for this one, that one, or the other. And so enter someone like Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary, who I think is many things at once. I think that he is a conservative culture warrior in the U.S. meaning of the word or expression. I think he is corrupt or kleptocratic or self-dealing in the American sense of those words. And I think he is a shrewd, calculating power consolidator. And so in a global context and in the context of Central Europe and Hungary, where he saw that he could self-deal, self-enrich, and consolidate power, he has done so. I only hasten to add, he didn't come from nowhere, like Donald Trump. And he's not without support inside Hungary, like Donald Trump in the United States. So I think to fix the problem, which I do think is real, and I think is illiberal, and I think is clearly authoritarian in tendency, means that we have to operate on a number of different fronts and a number of different levels.
So Norm, same question to you.
Well, I would add to the, a couple of notes to the Hungary analysis and then broaden it out a little bit regionally. We too often focus on the the challenges, it's the threats and the damage that gets attention. We don't always appreciate, as you point out, that now we'll see if he follows through, but that Orban has capped, he's put an end date on these emergencies. I don't think he's doing that out of the goodness of his heart. I believe he would love to have them continue forever. It's that endurance of democracy, that democratic energy that Jeff was alluding to, that forces the hand of people like Orban. We had another very good example of that recently. Jeff and I were involved on behalf of the TDWG, the Transatlantic Democracy Working Group, with the Polish elections. In the midst of the coronavirus, we feared that the ruling Law and Justice Party would take advantage of the crisis to insist the elections take place and benefit from a depressed turnout. There was an international outcry. Various people spoke out all over the world and in Poland, where it's one of the lessons of democracy's defenders. It's the home outcry that matters the most, the domestic fight for democracy. And the rest of us have to think, and in our conversations at TDWG, we bolstered this. How can we support those who are fighting for democracy on the front lines? Lo and behold, in response to national international pressure, the Polish regime backed off. There are very worrying signs, particularly around judges, that continue to be alarming in Poland, a resurgence of anti-Semitism. But at least in this one instance of the election in the time of Corona, democratic energy helped cause a more democratic outcome, the postponement of the elections.
So thank you, Norm. I want to start to bring in some of our audience questions. Many are already rolling in, and we have about 20 minutes left in our conversation. So I want to make sure that we get some here on the table. So we have one from Andrew, who I think you know well, Norm, your very own former research assistant, who asks, I'd be curious to hear how these cables complement and expand upon those published previously in the Prague, Washington, Prague volume. Norm, over to you.
Well, hello to Andrew Keneally, my former research assistant, now getting his PhD at Duke. And I tried to get Andrew to be a co-author on this book, Alina, but he dodged me. He's written a very important piece himself on the lessons of the year, and more broadly, that is coming out shortly. Andrew, I think, as you well know, the cables add a dimension to the previously existing cables, because they teach us, if I had to pick one lesson, they teach us that the outcome was not foreordained, that right up until the time that power was transferred at the end of the year in those two crucial months of November and December, it could have gone the other way. One of the most important gleanings from these cables that readers will see is that there was a continued worry about violence from the regime. This was the era of Tiananmen Square. Other communist transitions, although they happened, were not so velvet. And there could have been violence here too, as happened elsewhere in Eastern Europe in the period. So the very skilled behind-the-scenes diplomacy of the ambassador and the embassy helped avert that. I will say the very public voice, you had a former child movie star, Shirley Temple, now Shirley Temple Black, who was the ambassador. Her very public identity and the fact that the world was watching and that the communist regime would be held accountable if there were violence. I think that comes out in the cables and her efforts to focus world attention on the situation in Czechoslovakia. And then, above all, I want to emphasize all of that was done in support of the Czech and Slovak people who were on the front lines. So the cables also highlight the importance of letting the Czechs and Slovaks lead in the fight for their own democracy.
Thank you, Norm. And Jeff, let me take the next question over to you. It is from Jeffrey, but that's not why I'm taking the question over to you. The question is this. What lessons from the Velvet Revolution can be applied to today's battle against populism and nativism? And I think here's the interesting point. With the backlash to this backlash, meaning populism itself is a backlash, but now we're seeing a backlash to that backlash occurring from in civil society. But Jeffrey says it's not coming in Western Europe, but in Central Europe. Isn't that ironic? What do you think accounts for this outcome?
Thank you, Alina, and to the questioner, Jeffrey, thank you. First, to the roots of the problem, I think there's no one-size-fits-all analysis. And as the question suggests, it can differ in regions, it can differ in countries. Let me just start with the Czech Republic. The populist surge in the Czech Republic began a couple or so years ago at a moment where there was low unemployment, relatively high growth, a small, manageable immigrant population, and no refugees, or 5 refugees, or 25 refugees. That's that piece. Across the border in Germany, there was a refugee crisis, and the admittance of about 1 million refugees several years ago. That's a big deal. But otherwise, in a country relatively cohesive with decent growth and decently low unemployment and a bad history with extremism in many serious and severe ways, but we've witnessed the rise of the AfD, a populist right-wing party, hodgepodge of different things, but that has come onto the scene in a relatively short amount of time, has established itself. It goes up and down in the polls, but it doesn't look like it's going to disappear. So to answer the question, let me give you a very unsatisfactory reply to Jeffrey who answered. What are the lessons that can be learned? One is let's work really hard on our description and diagnosis of what the problem is and the roots, however multifaceted. And back to Norm's fine book and the cables, the diplomats are always trying to figure out, are we working with a complete data set? Are we seeing everything? Do we have 20/20 vision? Okay, we don't. But how do we make sure that we're looking at this from all actors and all angles? The second thing, to go back to the book and the cables, to combat these things, it's a mix of carrots and sticks and short-term and medium to longer term. One can't do everything at once. And whatever it is we're seeing, Jeffrey and others, that's happening today in Central Europe, if we're focused on that region, it's still a snapshot. We're involved in a film or a novel with multiple characters and multiple plots. Something came before and something will come after. So I think somehow we have to contextualize, get a bigger picture, and make sure we're describing the problem properly. And as I suggested, Germany is different from the Czech Republic. The Czech Republic is different from, pick a country, Great Britain, and how it's Brexited. But in each instance, to come up with a one-size-fits-all, best practice is very important, but a one-size-fits-all lessons learned, I'm very interested and I'm very cautious.
Thank you, Jeff. Norm, I want to give you an opportunity to comment on that question, but let me throw another question on top of it. And I think this is a very relevant one for young people today, especially those graduating right now, coming out of college and considering career opportunities perhaps in U.S. diplomacy. And this is from Julia, who says, do you have recommendations for young adults in the U.S. with an interest in national service, diplomacy, intelligence community, et cetera, but feel hesitant about serving in these institutions since 2016? Is it unreasonable to pursue such career paths? And if so, is there a scenario that would cause you to change your mind about that in the future? Norm?
Well, I have a long-running debate on this question, although it's principally focused on the senior levels of government, with some of my colleagues and friends who disagree on whether individuals of good faith in the most senior political echelons should join the Trump administration. Are they doing more good or harm by lending their good name to that profoundly flawed enterprise? I'm of the view that, we have a madman at the controls of the plane, so we'd better try to get a responsible co-pilot in there. So I want to see as many good people as possible go into the enterprise, and they actually can make a difference to how policy is conducted. That is even more true, Julia, for younger folks. I would encourage everyone to come in to the administration, one, because I believe there is going to be a reckoning and a repudiation of the lack of leadership that we're seeing. And when that happens, sooner or later, and I think it's going to be sooner, we are going to need the best young people. So beat the line. Now is the time, if you're interested in diplomacy, the intelligence community, federal law enforcement, public policy, but you feel hesitant, now is the time to sign up. We need you. This is a huge enterprise. And when we hit the ejector seat on that pilot, we're going to need some very good co-pilots to help land the plane. So please do come aboard.
I just want to emphasize what you just said, Norm. Getting this question sometimes from young people graduating college right now, these very unfortunate circumstances, and asking themselves this question that many have asked themselves in the past about, especially the professional career track when it comes to being a foreign service officer, a civil servant. And I agree with you. I say get in now. Get in now while there will be, you know, opportunities in, down the road. If you're a foreign service officer, you're not in Washington most of the time in your career anyways. So you don't have to worry about anything you might think about, any of the ramifications you might experience. So I just agree with you. I think we need to build the bench, and we need to have the best and the brightest defending U.S. diplomacy across the world, because at the end of the day, the U.S. has been a force for the spread of democracy across the world and more than one occasion, let's just say that. Now, Jeff, I don't know if you want to comment on that question about what young people should be considering or thinking about joining a public service. And let me throw another one on top of that. And I'm going to paraphrase a little bit from a question coming from Chandler, who asks, you know, if we see what's happening today in a broader historical perspective, so more of the kind of long tail of what's happening today, do you think that the President Trump's policies have been permanently damaging to transatlantic democracy and institutions?
So Alina, thank you. I'll say something about Chandler's question and also go back to Julia for a moment. I'm not a supporter of the president, and I think damage is being done. Do I think it's permanent? No. There's one of these, gosh, which one? Someone will text. But one of these old movies with Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon. I even forget what the context is, where Jack Lemmon says to Walter Matthau, "It's too late." And Walter Matthau says, "It's not too late. It's never too late. That's why they invented death." So we've been through a lot in this country. Good heavens. I've alluded to some of those big things that we've struggled with and against and overcome. I take the problem seriously. I think the hill to climb is a big one. But no, I don't think any damage being done right now is creating obstacles that are insurmountable. And that takes us back to Julia's comment. And I appreciate it, and I appreciate its sincerity, because it's not a great time to join the Foreign Service, for example, for a variety of reasons. But again, and I don't mean to be at all glib, because I do take it seriously, and people's time and resources and commitment to studies and professional development, Foreign Service exam, it's all very important. But this whole panel is about Norm's book and Defenders of Democracy. And thank God, if I may say, we live in a democracy. So if you don't like Donald Trump, we have elections in November. If it doesn't produce the outcome you like, we have elections again in 4 years. He's not president for life, or the next 20 years, or the next 10 years. Now, a bunch of other things are going on, and I don't minimize how complicated and difficult it is, but as individuals, and I pardon and second what Norm said, beat the line, and we all have a way to do some kind of contribution and service. I would say, Norm and Lena, when people come to me for help in job hunting, and sometimes young professionals, we all can find it daunting, I always say to them, don't forget you're looking for one job, not 17 or 325, one. So as individuals on this call, if you're thinking about this, that, or the other career path, you're thinking about what you can do for a meaningful career where you can make a contribution. And the rest, let it be a little bit. And it will develop, I think, in a very positive way.
Take it from me and Jeff, because between the two of us, we've had at least 25 jobs. I mean, maybe we're not very qualified to give job advice, Jeff. We can't hold down a job. I just counted in my head. I've had 14 since I graduated from college.
Stop counting. For both our sakes.
Yeah,
that I should be
in that game. In the job counting game. Well, let me just ask maybe one final question before we wrap up. And this one comes from Sejong. And it really brings in a more of a geopolitical perspective into the conversation we're having, having to do with China, of course. And let me just paraphrase the question. What is the appropriate strategy for the United States to pursue, given the state of the Transatlantic Alliance today and the state of democracy that we've been discussing, to continue to push global democratic governance while still outweighing China's growing authoritarian influence? Norm, thoughts?
Well, the rivalry on the geopolitical stage, including in Central and Eastern Europe, although you see it all over the world, the rivalry between America and China is one of the signal challenges to democracy, because the Chinese really do pose an alternative model, and they back that model with substantial financial might, often willing to spend in places, including in the Czech Republic, in ways that the United States government no longer does. I'll say parenthetically, one of the, to me, the single biggest thing I learned from the book was, Jeff alluded to this earlier, was the pitfalls of those kinds of government investments and the way the United States decided it was going to anchor the new democracy. Maybe this has a lesson for dealing with China. The United States decided it would anchor the new democracy in Czechoslovakia by spending to prop up the, or to build a market economy on the idea that that was a necessary and sufficient condition for democracy. It turned out not to work quite that way. And the investments that the United States made in the radical, the shock therapy and coupon privatization of the post-Velvet Revolution years ended up seeding a fair amount of corruption that afflicts democracy in the Czech Republic and Slovakia today. So to bring that around to the China example, I think that the Chinese spending is an overrated threat. You know, the America, despite the blemishes we've taken on, we've done that before. We withdrew from the world stage. We were in a terrible depression in the 1930s. And much as people are casting an eye towards China now, people were looking towards Soviet Russia, where Stalin was claiming not just endurance, but year over year GDP dramatic growth as a result, he said, of his superior system. In the long run in history, and this is a lesson of democracy's defenders, in the long run, the power of democracy, the power of the hopes and aspirations of the people when they're liberated for political exercise, to exercise their rights of speech and inquiry. And yes, the power of economic, genuine economic market competition, all of the baskets, the power to have protection of the rule of law, all of the things that democracy offers that China denies and compromises, either offering half measures, bastardized versions, or none at all, including in those market investments. The Czechs had a tremendous shock when the Chinese government took over a private investment that a Chinese company had made. And suddenly the Czechs found that there was a Chinese government owner for this business in the Czech Republic. So I think the system will endure, and I think we will overcome the momentary lapses. Our best days, both as American democratic and diplomatic leaders and for transatlantic democracy, lie ahead of us.
Thank you, Norm. Jeff, 30-second response and final word.
Sure. Insofar as we have a quarrel, it's not with the people of China, it's with the regime of China. Democracy matters. And second of all, we're not the only ones in the room. And I think as much as we can do to confer, consult, and listen to our other democratic allies in Europe and in the region, including Japan and Taiwan and others, would be very, very valuable.
Thank you, Jeff. That was very succinct. I want to take us out of the discussion. I'll give Norm the final goodbye. But before I do that, I'm going to remind everyone, this is the book. It is available for purchase at the Brookings Institution Press and elsewhere on the internet. And it is a wonderful read to remind us all of some hard-learned lessons about the how democracy was really won and fought for by the United States, working closely together with our allies on the ground. And look at this if you need a reminder of why all those values and principles continue to be so important today. So Norm, let me hand it over to you. Thank you for the book, to you and your colleagues. Thank you, Jeff, for adding your perspective. Fascinating history both of you have had with Czech Republic especially. Couldn't have thought of a better conversation partner than you, Jeff, and of course you, Norm. So Norm, final word over to you.
I'll try to emulate Jeff's brevity. Thank you, Alina. Thank you, Jeff. Thanks to everybody at Brookings for putting this on, and the Brookings Press for the book, to my co-authors. The link to the book should be at the bottom of your screens, everybody. If not, Democracy's Defenders, available at the Brookings Press website and online everywhere. Goes without saying that the void of American leadership, the behavior of America at the top levels in the era of COVID has betrayed every principle we write about in Democracy's Defenders. But if there's one thing that I took away from this book, it is the endurance and the power of democratic energy and transatlantic democracy in its full form will be back and better than ever, I predict, before we know it. We've come back from dark places before on both sides of the Atlantic in the roughly 300-year history, 300-year plus history of modern democracy. And we will do it again. Read Democracy's Defenders to find out a little bit about why the past is prologue.
And with that, thank you for joining us, and goodbye.